This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
It's my pleasure to welcome everyone to today's proceedings. I'd like to especially welcome our speaker, Michael Gibbons, and also the Irish ambassador, who we're very privileged to have with us today. From the vantage point of Australia, Ireland seems to be one of the most lively areas of archaeology in Western Europe, and a very well organised public infrastructure for archaeology, at least from our perspective. So I'm doubly pleased to be able to welcome a fellow archaeologist to the museum today, and I look forward to hearing what Michael has to tell us. I must say that his visit is very short. It's just a whistle-stop visit to Canberra, and he's sponsored by Culture Ireland. But before we proceed with Mike's talk, I'd like to introduce Richard Reid, who most of you know. He's been working with the museum on an exhibition looking at the Irish in Australia, and Richard is really our connection to Ireland, and he will do a more formal introduction for our speaker, Michael.
Thanks, Mike. I like that thought. Our connection to Ireland. I'll have to work on that. Does that mean I can have sort of a visit every couple of months or something? We'll think about that. But it's my great pleasure to welcome Michael Gibbons here today and to tell you a little bit about him. When I first met Michael, you've got to imagine this character to my right here, who sort of dressed in working clothes and boots, will throw himself into the centre of a bog, quite literally, and pick up a piece of peat and start talking to elderly Australians about the significance of the bogs of Ireland and what the treasures that they contain. But Michael certainly is one of the, how can I put it, one of the dynamic forces, as far as I can understand it, in archaeology in Ireland. One of the things that he's done, and he may speak a bit more about this anyway, and it bears reflecting upon, given the nature of the way we come to work in the morning. We drive our cars in here, or we get the bus, or whatever it is. Michael, for a period of about 4 or 5 months, Michael, was it? Yeah. Was driving every day from Clifton in Galway, where he lives, to the foot of a mountain, Cropatrick Mountain, and then walking up this very arduous trek right to the very top every day. To excavate an ancient church there that I'm sure he will tell you about. So there's not many of us that have that kind of background or experience. Even Mike was saying desert archaeology is full of pain and misery, Mike, but that kind of archaeology at the top of a mountain every morning, probably equally so. But we contacted the Irish Embassy to try and get Michael out here because we've just been running a weekend conference out at St. Clement's at Geelong at the monastery out there in Ned Ryan's ancient home to talk about the famine in Ireland and to talk about the sites in Ireland that are identified with the famine. One of the things that Michael is really bringing to us here is the fact that there's a part of archaeology in Ireland that's been totally overlooked. Most of you would have in your mind, you know, ancient Celtic sites, sites of churches, sites of ancient fortresses, whole range of things that, you know, are very familiar when you think of the ancient Celtic context of Ireland. But what I think Michael is bringing to all this, living as he does in the west of Ireland, is the fact that there are hundreds and hundreds of remains of the mid-19th century, of people who fled from the famine, who left their cabins, who left their villages, who left the places that they were living in, and that by and large Irish archaeologists and historians ignored those sites. Well, up until the present day, Michael's one of the very few people who's begun to actually begin to look at those places. And from an Australian point of view, of course, that is significant for us because we're looking, when we're looking at those sort of places, at the context out of which so many thousands and thousands and thousands of Irish people came to Australia in the 19th century. So although it might seem a little tenuous to talk about Irish archaeology, Irish archaeology of the 19th century actually can link very solidly into what we're trying to do here in the museum in a couple of years, which is put up an exhibition on the Irish in Australia. So you don't want to hear from me, you want to hear from someone who knows about these places on the ground. I'm sure he's going to touch on the famine. He's nodding. He's thinking about it. but anyway, it's my great pleasure to introduce to you Michael Gibbons.
It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm going to talk today just a little bit about the background. I worked for 10 years directing a national survey program all over Ireland. and our task was sort of broad, to map the antiquities of Ireland from the Mesolithic through to the 17th century, using a host and a range of variety of sources, including oral history, 17th century counts, early studies of the landscape, private memoirs, ordnance survey letters, and a whole array of material. And this was done immediately prior to the economic boom that we've been experiencing for the last 15 years, stuttering a little bit at the moment, but up to last weekend, literally. So in advance of that boom, there was a major government program of rapid surveys, trying to get and collate a vast array of material on the landscape, and from that material, issuing planning constraint documents. And it was very unfortunate that this was actually done, because it happened before the boom happened. So in that process, we documented about, I suppose, over 100,000 monuments throughout the Irish landscape, covering a vast array of material. One should say you should never apply for a job that you don't want, because you might be offered it. And I applied for this job when I'm working on this particular island here, the Arden Islands. And I got the job, I suppose, because I came from a background of field archaeology and had been mapping the uplands and islands on the west coast in particular. These are islands, some and uplands, which have a continuing living spiritual tradition in the pilgrimage tradition that survives today on these islands. So we had uncovered a huge array of material previously unmapped in this area. So we brought new techniques to map that. So Ireland today has a very large and deep archaeological infrastructure, mostly in the private sector. 9 out of 10 archaeologists in Ireland work in the private sector. We have a growing public sector, but it's been overstripped. And there's areas of Irish landscape in particular which had been ignored completely, which now there's major advances being made in. And in particular, I refer here to marine and intertidal zone archaeology, which is a very growing field in Ireland. So after 10,000 years, we've suddenly woken up to the fact that we live on an island, and scholarship at a very high level has been funded on some of these projects. So I want to talk today on one small project, which will touch on aspects of early Christian, medieval, and post-medieval landscapes. And it's a project that I was involved in, and still am, on the Arden Islands, which is a wonderful block of islands off the west coast. There are barrier islands, they're midway along the western seaboard, and draped across them, there's this great palimpsest of archaeology. And this is the Inishmore, the big barrier reef of islands here. And these are ribbed with a whole series of early field systems. And those field systems have their origins in some places in the Bronze Age. And that pattern laid down then continues on in subsequent generations and right out through and expanded in the 19th century. So it's one of the great archaeological landscapes of Western Europe. It's a continuation of the Boreen uplands in Clare. So there's, and plus on overlaying that, there's a historic memory. There's an oral tradition on the island here, which is very old and very deep and multi-layered. And I was fortunate having grown up in this area and have had huge contact with islanders in themselves who are comfortable with me as a Connemara person from across the water, and lots of sites coming to light due to personal contact alone. So there's a living oral heritage in the landscape here that traditional archaeologists prior to that, often coming from a sort of distant culture, if you like, hadn't or didn't get access to this material. So there's an oral history here. There's an Irish language survival here on the island. And so I'll be combining elements of those together in this presentation. The Port of Arran I'm going to focus on initially. The Port of Arran, this was a great medieval harbour on the west coast of Arran. And this is as you view out to the present harbour at Kilania, the Church of St. Enda. The Arran Islands is known in Irish as Ara na Niamh, Arran of the Saints. It was considered sacred ground in early historic times. There's about 15 early monastic sites scattered across it. So there's a legendary and a dimension to the origins of early Christian Arran. This is a view of the island chain. This is one of the islands. First thing you strike you, it's got a very serrated edge. It's got this cliff-bound 100-meter-high cliffs. And back, and you've got this grain sheet of rock. These are limestone reefs. These reefs have attracted first settlement on the islands here goes back to the Neolithic. So scattered across this landscape, you have a series of Neolithic tombs. In the waters just to the north of it, we've identified in Inner Galway Bay, this is at the mouth of Galway Bay, a series of Mesolithic sites, so dating back between 6 and 8,000 years ago. Hunter-gatherer populations being the earliest group we have in Ireland. Post-Ice Age, around 10,000, we have the emergence of a Mesolithic societies in Ireland. And for the next 4,000 years, there's a very conservative indigenous hunter-gatherer groups living in a world without any large mammals. So early Mesolithic settlement in Ireland is in a land with no large mammals. The largest thing is a wild boar. So a very unusual Mesolithic environment. This island in the Neolithic would have been covered in a light tree cover. We have evidence for that from a series of pollen cores from Loch Moore. In the Neolithic, there's a massive expansion of settlement. So you have these waves or pulses of settlement right across the island. So many of the megalithic tombs on Aran are known as Laba Dermot agus Gráinne, the bed of Dermot and Gráinne, two lovers that elope and are chased around the island. They're not known as boring megalithic tombs. So there's an oral history which interprets the monuments in a particular way. If you're open to that oral history and listen to it and hear it, you have an oblique angle in onto the landscape. So when I was mapping this area, we found about 50 previously unrecognized megalithic tombs, mostly from following up oral history. So this is why it's quite a fascinating landscape. You've got this interface between a folklore dimension to it and the archaeology itself, which is still alive. And now this culture is not alive in most of the rest of Ireland. It's fading out fast. So in the Neolithic, these landscapes are peopled, thickly peopled. There's a large amount of Neolithic sites here. And in the subsequent Bronze Age, there's another wave of settlement into these elements. So you have these peaks and troughs through the Irish landscape. And because you have a world, a culture of small farms, traditional belief systems, there's a tremendous reluctance to damage or interfere with these monuments. So you have another sort of protective mantle, if you like, placed on the landscape by a sort of conservative small farmer fishing world that are fearful of interfering with these monuments. And again, so as you go across Ireland, if you look of Ireland as a zone of survival of Europe, aspects of European culture, the further west or up you go, that is more to the west and more in the uplands. So we have more traditional ways still surviving here. It means we have this unparalleled prehistoric landscape surviving here. And you have later settlement on top of it and another layer on top of that again. On Aran, it's particularly important where you have an island with lots of stone and little soil. So monuments just get built and rebuilt, rarely robbed out. In the middle here, there's a village associated with Limo Flaherty, Gurtin na Gopal, tiny little settlement there just up against the crag. So you have little pockets of soil where the modern settlement is located. These white dots are the modern settlement. But the back of the island, as you look at it here, this is now cleaned out or scoured out, but there's a skeletal framework of early field systems across that, and some of these are very early. This is a landscape, and you look down on it. Now, these walls, I suppose it's the single biggest artifact on the Aran Islands, is the later wall systems, and these are multi-phased. The last big push here was in the 19th century, when you had population expansion out of the villages, and every corner and every inch of ground being enclosed and settled. And even despite that there's no soil within a lot of these fields, there is grazing. These are good grazing grounds. There's like a giant radiator. The island is radiating heat, so there's a long growing season here. People from Connemara used to bring their cattle out to Aran to graze them, for example. So there's a within this field system, you have early Christian, medieval, prehistoric, and 19th century field systems, all seamlessly running into another. On the north side, you have some macker dunes, coastal dune sites. So you have some very shallow, fragile soils, so literally 20 centimeters deep. And so you have some very interesting dune archaeology here. So with eroding dunes and powerful storm surges, you have the erosion of some of these softer coasts. Now, most of Ireland isn't particularly soft, but in places where you have it, you're getting a series of coastal dunes. In the West here, the earliest description we have is 1837. George Petrie describing a great mound of sand being blown off and a scarab raid type village uncovered beneath the sands. The wind continues to blow and this ancient village that gets covered in. So this narrow strip, this green strip here, is enclosed macher, something similar to you get in the Outer Hebrides. And it's very rich in archaeology. When you look at the island from the air, and one of the things we did when we were mapping, we used very traditional survey methods, and we also went back to basics. We got the earliest vertical aerial photography. And in Ireland, we have very good vertical photography from the 1940s. This material had been considered too high, too coarse to be of any use for settlement studies, a famous quote from David Wilson in Cambridge. But of course, he was looking at it with the wrong. He had no proper optics. So once you look at these aerial photography, and we did a lot of our mapping using 1940s vertical photography. And this is a vertical view down onto Killeney Harbour, where you have a modern settlement here, and then the field systems running back across it. So this is the only sheltered anchorage along this entire stretch of coast here. So the Fasca La Fallon, there's shelter to be had here. So this was the key site throughout the last 1,500 years on this island chain. And the island's location, it's midway along the west coast of Ireland, 15 miles offshore. So nothing moving up and down past these islands since the Neolithic would have gone on without either landing or having to deal with whoever's occupying these islands. So it's like a choke chain on this. Nothing goes in and out through these islands without the islanders having a say in what's happening. In early Christian times, the Iron Islands are a major source of pilgrimage. They're right here. So they're located off the west coast. And in early historic times, Ireland becomes Christian in the 5th century. It becomes Christian from contact with Roman Britain. Patrick is the most famous character associated with this event. Patrick of Britain, Romanized. He comes to Ireland. But Palladius is there in 431, and there's a whole raft of other Secundius, Auxilius from the 5th century or thereabouts. The Romans don't occupy Ireland, but that doesn't mean there isn't Roman influence in Ireland. You have to imagine parts of the east and south of Ireland in contact with Roman Britain over 4 centuries being partially Romanized, if you like, and further west, the more wilder Irish, if you like. So you don't have to have a direct occupation to have an influence. And Christianity is coming to Ireland in that contact phase between Ireland and now Christian Britain. But the Irish, of course, go against the trend. The Roman legions are pulled out of Britain. The Franks are overrunning Gaul. And the Irish are adopting the religious culture of a failed experiment of 4 centuries of Roman occupation. And Christianity takes deep roots in the Irish landscape very fast. And this is something we're not quite sure what happens. It takes roots in a world of a plethora of local saints and local deities. The most powerful saint in this area, for example, is Mac Dara, son of the oak. Son of the oak is a fox or a wolf. So many of the saints in Ireland, these dots are representing just some of the 3,000 early Christian monasteries in Ireland. It's a vast landscape, are having their origins pre-Christian deities, but just immediately pre-Christian. They're not from the deep past. But throughout early text, we have the Iron Islands figure prominently in them. And it's because of their location on the western seaboard. In later early historic times, you have this an amazing array of fortified settlements. You have them in the high mountain tops, and you have them all along the coast of Brittany up to the Shetland Islands, and these are coastal promontory forts. And this is one of the more spectacular of them. It's Dún Dúchathair, the Black Fort. And it's got a massive rampart, houses within it, and a series of houses further back. None of this has been excavated now, so the dates are a little bit tentative. A similar site to this as Dún Aengus has been dated to the late Bronze Age, around 1200 BC, and a later reuse of the site in around the 7th, 8th century. So this main rampart here may well date to 8th, 9th century, sort of reuse of it. Here there's the remains of a village, oval-shaped houses, some of which have been partially restored in the 19th century, and outside of it, a chevaux de frise, a very interesting feature, this line of stones here. This is a barrier of upright stones, some partially rubbed out now, to provide a block against onrushing troops on foot or on horse. So people trying to get their head around this feature. Why would you need all of this on an island that's already incredibly difficult to walk across? Of course, when this site has been built, there's probably a thin sod. So this is like a heath on the island. But this site will date possibly to the late Bronze Age and then reuse in the early Christian period. So the islands at this stage have seven of these great forts right across, forming this incredible chain across the islands. So there's someone in control of the islands. They're barrier islands, they're strategically significant, and there's high status sites being fortified here. I'll just flick through that. The other dynamic on these islands, and this is all along the coast now, which we're increasingly seeing, is there's been 10 metres of sea level rise along the west coast of Ireland. That's a massive amount of land. So there's a huge array, just recently been recognised now, within the intertidal zone. So there's a whole landscapes literally emerging as we speak. And this is an area I've been doing some work on in Galway Bay, which is a very large and tortuous coastline. Just underneath the plain there, there's just the remains. We don't have a pointer, do we? Sorry. No, it's fine. You probably can see there, where the body of water is over here, there's the remains of a coaxial, or as Fleming calls it, terrain oblivious field system coming out here. This is one wall, there's a cross wall here. Walls coming this way. So this is a wall, a landscape that has emerged as the sea has risen and ate its way into this coastal dune system. Those walls, you can trace them under the dunes, up onto through the modern, so-called modern fields, right out onto the edge of the cliffs. We don't have a date on them, unfortunately. The dates of these field systems on the west coast of Ireland go back as far as early Neolithic. So this one is still floating in time and space, if you like. But we have good evidence for Bronze Age field systems like this on the Burren adjacent to it, and early Christian ones also. When these walls are coming up, this is what you're finding. And this, anyone who plays golf, every links course in Ireland, and probably in Scotland, has features like this immediately underneath it. And some of the work I've been doing is with golf courses, trying to get them to avoid this type of stuff or mitigate the impacts. Because this is a thin sod. As it's getting overblown out now, there's a lot of evidence for increased wind speeds on the west coast. This is what's happening to some of these very fragile ecosystems. But this is part of that intertidal field system. It covers an area about 700 acres, the whole east end of the island. Further over, on the right is Dún Aengus. This is our sort of control site, if you like, on Arran. It's the only site that's been substantial excavations on it. It's a multi-valid ramparted fortress. Now, during the aerial survey that we carried out, we found about 30 of these monuments. Dún Aengus is about 12 acres in area, the site of the top right. Some of the sites we came on were up to 300 acres in area. Famous site in West Wicklow. In Knocknashee, the Hill of the Fairies, a wonderful site in Turbocurry in central Sligo, an enormous hill fort, 54 acres. So some of the sites we're identifying in the landscape have been too big that we missed them before, are very small and subtle landscapes. We didn't ever even bother to look. Our eyes weren't open to the potential that these sites have. But this site on the right here has been published by Claire Cotter, or partially published recently. This is the island chain right across, with a great group of these stone forts scattered right across the island. These are mirrored on the mainland, and you have similar sites on some of our lakes in the form of stone castles or island forts, stone built on some of the western lakes. These are similar to the ones you get in the Scotland, in the Outer Hebrides, for example. Overlooking Killarney in particular, you have this iconic church. It's right on the bluff of the hill. It's marking a line of sight to give you access straight into the harbour of Killarney. So it dates from the 10th century. There's a little cell to the right, so it's a very spectacular sight. You can see it from the mainland 12 miles away. And this is a small chapel. Within the early Christian church, you have a tremendous variety, but a lot of small chapels are being built as private chapels or shrines for relics. So there's if you need an extra chapel in an early monastery, you build an extra one. So often you'll get multiple churches and chapels, private So church sites fulfill all sorts of different functions in society. One of them, interestingly, is a sort of old folks' home for clapped out Gaelic lords, past their sell-by date and are often elbowed out of power by more ambitious younger sons. So they're holy orders, Dad, while we get on with the business of expanding the territory of the lords. On Arran, the family in charge in the early historic team program period are the Onochtha, the people of Munster. And one of these great forts is called Dún Onochtha. Onochtha, this great province in the south of Ireland. The O'Briens later emerge as the big powerful family from that sept. And Arran in the 12th century onwards is controlled by the O'Brien sept. So and of course having an island associated with St. Enda, one of the founder figures of the early church in Ireland, has huge status attached to it. So control of Arran is not just for strategic, military, political reasons, it's also for religious reasons. And having one of these powerful saints as part of your intellectual armoury is very significant. So if you're a minor sept and you're rising up through the ranks of early Christian Ireland and you're a nobody, you're growing powerful militarily, what you have to do is commission a saint's life. First item on the agenda, an ambitious young sept. So you cannibalise the life of Bridget, Patrick, Finbar, anyone else that you can get your hands on, and you concoct a whole new saint's lives. So in Ireland we've lots of early texts and some of them are saints' lives. But saints' lives are a bit like the science fiction of the Middle Ages. Elements of it you can see into the landscape and insights into the culture, but they're not real history, but they're very, very important. And on Arran we have a saint's life of Saint Enda, which is hugely interesting. This is a 12th century life describing Arran. No one but God alone knows the number of saints buried here. So it's a very, very, in the early church, Arran is a special place. I'll flick through some of these. The oral and the hagiographic evidence combined to create a parallel geography which overlap and complement the mundane ones. And this is what's fascinating. You have unusual aspects of the marine landscape are interpreted by reference to traditions arranged around the Christianization of the islands. So in an island that's all limestone, what does that mean? Well, it means if you've got a great big glacial erratic made of granite deposited 15,000 years ago by a glacier, these are known in Arran as Strangchori o Connemara, strangers from Connemara. They are strangers because they came in the last ice age, but a number of them are being interpreted in a very specific way as stone boats. And you have this tradition in northwestern Europe of stone boats associated with St. Enda on Arran, St. Columbkill, and of course most famously with St. James. And lots of legends about floating boats and James arriving in Santiago in one of them. Those traditions are still practiced and believed in some of the coastal communities in Cosharaga and on the Arran Islands. And Enda is one of these figures. Now you have this, and this is what a stone boat would look like. And I've been mapping these stone boats. Now, marine archaeologists have difficulty accepting these as part of marine archaeology, but I have no problem taking it because within the oral history, this is a boat. There's ribbing there. It looks a bit ragged. It's gone through many a storm. But this stone, in the form of a boat, is what brought Christianity to Arran, Gerer and Shanachas. According to the tradition, Enda arrived on Arran in a stone boat. Got caught between a rock and a hard place, and they were stuck on this cliff-bound island, and an angel with a flaming sword gouged out a natural entrance into the island. Now when you look, I hope I have a shot of it, when you look at the stone from above, from the air, you've got this perfect natural entrance running into the island. So you've got this wonderful correspondence with physical reality, an oral history, which still points out, if you go to Arran today and ask for Bod Columbkill, or Bod's Nevinda, Nevenia, they'll point out the stone boat to you. And on the Cosharaga coast, where I was there recently, an old lady pointed me out all the ribbing and all the rigging, the anchor, everything on this massive boat on the shore at Clochmore on the opposite coast. So occasionally they have a boat in reserve. Linking these boats, you also have Cossan na Níomh, the footpath of the saints, and you have subsea roads in addition to stone boats. So you've got all sorts of angelic engineering going on. And this is the entrance here. If you can see it, it looks like it's been cut. It's giving access into a wonderful lagoon. And this is again one of the early texts. Dawach, Port Dawach. This is the name of the little harbour at the eastern end of the island. And this is the explanation as what happened here. Finda in a cask transport herself to the island. This duly happened. And of course, Corbin, the giant, heads off at this miraculous arriving. So invariably these saints are in opposition to what was perceived as a pagan deity prior to it. And these points, this landscape, of course, has been incredibly well read and documented by a marvellous scholar called Tim Robinson, who I've worked on this island and on Connemara over many years. This is extreme. India is an extreme edge of the early Christian world. He instructs his disciples to go naked into the frame of a curragh. If water entered, they were said to be in a state of sin. So the early Irish church is a sort of fundamentalist edge to it, the Kaleidhe, and they're all into all sorts of extreme pain and carrying out all sorts of purges on themselves. This is a curragh, this traditional boat still in use on the west coast. So these are part of the maritime history and archaeology that is still current and still made and still used. They're in use because they're valuable. They're current and they've got a use. They're not kept. They don't fish lobster off these cliffs because they like the look of the boat. There's very practical reasons for it. In this landscape, we have a series of accounts from the annals. We have early texts, written sort of diary accounts in Ireland going back to the 7th century, year by year blows of what's happening. Some areas are well documented. Aran is quite well documented. Viking raids, raiding Ireland from 795, but then later raids, probably coming from the Hebrides into the 11th century. And why are they attacking Aran? Because it's strategically important. It's also religiously significant. It's like robbing the bank. There's wealth concentrated. These are sites of tremendous patronage. The Gaelic lords, the O'Briens, are patronizing. They're commissioning works of art. So these are wealthy monasteries. There is contact in the early period with France and with Gaul. We know that from Eware pottery imported into places like Riesk in the southwest. So Ireland remains, in this period, it's a thriving population. The population is rising in early Christian Ireland. It's rising because the economy switches to a dairying economy. And there is contact, but not as much as you'd think. But it's a major religious destination within Ireland. That tradition survives today on an island immediately opposite. Northern Islanders go, ironically now, on pilgrimage to an adjacent island, Mochdara's Island. This is Mochdara, the son of the oak. So we've been looking at maritime pilgrimages. I'm involved in a research project on maritime and mountain pilgrimages in the West. And there's 7 or 8 of these mountain and island pilgrimages. The West Coast, as depicted in the earliest maps we have, if you leave Ptolemy aside, 14th century maps here. The Aran Islands picked out here, for example, very accurately depicted location-wise, but Galway City isn't on the map. Galway City is a medieval Norman state, so the islands are very important and significant. So the cartography has a lot to answer for. The islands themselves, though, are clearly picked out because these are maritime charts being passed back and up. The medieval history of Ireland. The island is in a cockpit between 3 major forces. There are the O'Flaherty lords on the mainland, there's the O'Brien lords in Munster, and increasingly there's the English encroachment to the west. Galway City is a little city-state, and so these islands are caught in this sort of caught in the mix, if you like, and these islands are sought after. So the O'Briens are elbowed out gradually by the O'Flaherty lords of Connemara, their long-time enemies to the north. Galway City is the rich city medieval state, and it's a wonderful map of it from the mid-17th century. Wonderful walled town, bastion corners, and jousting on it. Galway was an old-fashioned town. The 17th century. Jousting had died out in medieval England years ago. Galway now has reinvented itself as a sort of heartbeat of Gaelic Ireland. In the medieval times, neither owe nor mock shall strut or swagger through the streets of Galway. They weren't allowed inside the gates. Irish town, the Claddagh, was outside it. But as you can see from the harbour, the very important harbour, direct trade with Spain, direct trade with the continent, and more importantly with Bristol. So this is the only decent sized Norman town on the west coast. A lot of it still preserved, very interesting site. So control of Aran and the trade into Galway, Aran Islands, comes more important in the Middle Ages. To get into this rich city-state, which is the lifeblood of trade, the Aran Islands control it. So you have to bribe the O'Flahertys or the O'Briens. So there's tribute paid to Gaelic lords to protect the shipping routes, or a straight off bribe. So the Arans are to the south, O'Brien country to the right, and O'Flaherty country to the north. This is the trade links here with the towns of Britain and further down into France. So these aren't, they're isolated in some ways and modernized, but in medieval times they're not. These are in trade up and down the west coast. The Borgo lords are vying for it. They're paying 12 tons of wine as tribute here. There's a lot of conflict going on in the west. The Gaelic lords and the now Gaelicized Anglo-Normans are vying for control of the island. And the accounts are coming back through official records, which is reflecting the difficult position Aran is. Always lie full of galleys to ensnare, capture, and plunder our liege English. So this is when you get the accounts of the Irish being pirates emerging. The O'Malleys and the O'Flahertys being pirates. They're not pirates, of course. These are tribal lands and tribal waters. Anyone in and out of these areas without negotiating their way in are fair game. They're taken. The stuff is sold off. But from a sort of feudal point of view, these chiefs have surrendered to their liege lord 2 centuries ago, and these are in open rebellion. So they are seen as piracy, while the local Gaelic lords are not seeing it as piracy. So there's two total different views of what the legal position is. The O'Briens and the O'Flahertys are constantly at war between it. The Elizabethans come into the mix, and they confiscate, during the Reformation, all church lands. Conveniently, Aran is Aran and Eve, Aran of the Saints. So the whole island chain is grabbed by the Elizabethans. It's ours. And they garrison it from the end of the 16th century. So there's an English garrison planted out here, which is very unusual. And they built a fort at Arkeen, replacing an O'Brien castle, which was later replaced itself. During the English Civil War, the great civil war that convulsed Ireland, these become important. And the island passed in and out of various people's hands. A fortress is built, and it's incorporating the medieval castle, and there's a harbour getting built. And our work on the harbour has revealed a whole series of new material. They're cannibalising. The later fort is robbing liberally from the early church, from an early castle, from a Franciscan friary, and they're cobbling it together and building it into the stonework of the new fort. This is a little fragment of a Romanesque church. To have a Romanesque church is a high status. You have wealth. So there's commissioned, this is a 12th century stonework in a 17th century building. And more work we did this summer now, we've revealed a whole array of additional fragments from this period. The harbour it's built is a classic 17th century fort, a star bastions along flanking towers along a square centre. In the 17th century, the island is used as a prison for captured Catholic clergy, some of which were shipped off elsewhere later. So in the Cromwellian Wars, it's a hugely important place because the Cromwellians' use of the navy is one of the key to their successes. The Irish are expelled from the coast. The state shall suffer no Irish to keep any boats on the coast of your Connacht or their adjacent islands. For a maritime island, this is pretty, you can't move without your boats. In this period, we were doing some fieldwork on the other islands, and we began to identify a number of forts and harbour features associated with these. So one of the harbours we picked out the remains of, and the nice track back, is there any reference to this in the documentation? And some of the earliest maps we had mention a harbour, but that can be a built harbour or an anchorage. But this French map here, 1684, shows a crude representation of a fort and a harbour. You can see to the right, the Aran Islands with a big star-shaped fort in the middle of it. And this is during the 17th century when the Irish are now broken, but not completely gone yet. They're negotiating with the Duke of Lorraine for assistance, for money, for troops, for men, which does come. And so you've got a lot of interest in fortifications of various sorts in and around the bay. This is 1690. Again, the French are patrolling the coast looking for good charts in anticipation of a landing on the west coast. And Aaron Killeney is here. And in that Killeney harbour, a detail comes up. They're marking a projection out into the water and a square red structure. And this is what we think it represented, the corner bastion of the 17th century fort. As you look down onto the harbour, it looks fairly unpromising, but revealed in the water and intertidal zone is this larger harbour, just faintly visible. Like a lot of things, it's faintly visible with the eye of faith. Mm-hmm. Because the harbour, which was quite a substantial building, was substantially robbed out in the 1820s when, in a period of distress, as it's called, an early 19th century harbour was built. And modern harbours are a disaster. When they're built near old works, they rob left, right and centre all around the country. But we were able to pick out this wall, for example, running for 50 metres along the bluff of the cliff. And further along, some cut stone in the intertidal zone. This is a 15th or early 16th century doorway, for example. This summer we found the remains of a market cross from around 1550, which would have stood in the middle of the then Killeney village before the fort was built. So the whole intertidal zone here is just littered with artifacts from the 17th century going back to the Middle Ages. So as one phase is robbing out the other. So there you might just get a faint idea of a line of walling along here. Again, this is the basal wall of quite a large ashlar block quay front. Very rare. It's one of only two harbours that survived that were built in along the west coast. So this is the later harbour down the top of the picture there. And this cannibalises not just the 17th century harbour, or medieval one, it also robs out a round tower, which was 90 feet tall, and it just strips the whole lot. So the harbour there contains the remains of the round tower, the medieval castle, Franciscan Abbey, and a whole lot of other stuff. So there's a huge array of material in this intertidal zone, the various other features. There's another segment of it running out. How am I doing for time? Okay, I won't be too long more. What I'll do afterwards, then, we can look at... So take some questions if you like, and look at how this whole new work in intertidal zone archaeology is fitting into the other sort of structure. This is part of that harbour. Now we've cleaned it back, took the weed off it, and more internal features within inside, and so it's quite an elaborate structure. We did work on it in late August, so I haven't got the latest plan on it. But hopefully it's going into nautical archaeology later on this year or early next year, if you know that term. Further down on it, a friend of mine, well, I've been at this site 20 times and missed the Romanesque church. I'd missed the early Christian church, the fragments of it. And I'd also missed the loops here, which are mooring irons, late medieval mooring loops to moor the boats tight up against the edge of the... So most of my career was involved in mapping upland houses and cairns and field systems and tombs. So if you're on the intertidal zone, sometimes you do miss stuff, and it takes someone with a pair of fresh eyes. Now, Jim Higgins is an expert on early Christian art. He was 5 minutes looking at this wall, and the whole thing just came alive, a wall that I'd been looking at for several years and not seeing. Colour infrared photography is useful, which we do use occasionally. And there you can have the marker points marking the entrance in. The harbour is in here. The village is here. And the karst is higher up there, the Graham. So this has been a very useful tool for mapping some of the intertidal causeways, which we've also found. Some of these are kilometre longs on the islands on the opposite shore, where there's a whole array of other intertidal zone archaeology. So we're using lots of different... fairly traditional techniques, survey techniques, with some newer survey methods, including LIDAR survey, which is beginning to be used now in Ireland fairly extensively, but on specific projects. Solid documentary research, all hugely important. So go back over sources. Other people often have kind of missed it. And in this case, Robertson's plan, 1780, where he marks the harbour, it's plan was published, but the archaeologists at the time, not looking at the intertidal zone, didn't even notice that there was a harbour here. So we've reassessed some of the features. The twin to this island was Inishbofin Island, 50 miles away. This island, similarly strategically important, not quite on the scale of Arran, and a fabulous star-shaped fort here on this island, with its own harbour adjacent to it. So once we started looking at these, this is a crescenting harbour, about 90 metres across, and there's a whole series of buildings that's come out of this. So this intertidal zone, having been ignored completely, because the realisation there was something really interesting in it, has proven to be hugely productive. Stranford Lock, major publication by Tom Ackerlane and his team up there. Aidan O'Sullivan working on the Shannon Estuary, mud flats, very difficult environment, but an enormous array from the Mesolithic to the 19th century turning up there. A galley here, image from Limerick, showing a representation of how this site may well have looked. You can see here, galley with a chain guarding the mouth. This is a city, Limerick is a rich city, or was in the medieval period. So we're looking at some of the evidence from the 17th century for other harbours around. And the presumption was that the native Irish built galleys but didn't build any harbours. This was a sort of one of these peculiar rooted notions that the Irish didn't build any harbours. But we've found loads of them now right across. Near the image of the fort, a conjecture plan that's not finished of how the harbour feature might have looked. So you have an outer natural harbour and an inner sheltered harbour inside it. In the 18th century, these harbours again change, again as they become major aspects of a smuggling trade, and there's a big 18th century maritime history that changes the use of these islands again. The remains of the tower inside it, and in the 18th century, the enormous growth in population all along this coastline. Some of this growth leading to robbing of some of the features and an addition of a whole array of other features. So Galway Bay and the islands around it, you've got intertidal trackways, intertidal mills, the biggest mill complex on the Irish west coast, we've identified it on Inner Galway Bay. A good deal of Bronze Age sites now are coming to light in the intertidal peat that is eroding out. And one Bronze Age row, which I found recently at Ballinakil Bay. So some of the intertidal zone archaeology is mirroring what you find on the land in terms of the form and shapes of it, but in other features, fish traps, for example, which we didn't identify before, we're now identifying them in large numbers. Anyway, I think I'll end at that. Just one example of one small project in an Ireland that's very dynamic in terms of the reach. I do a lot of work on upland archaeology. The intertidal zone, I suppose, is a new frontier in Irish archaeology. And it's one that there's a lot of new energy and exciting work being done in. So I just thought I'd give you an insight into one particular small project, which touches on lots of areas, hopefully. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert. That was an absolutely fascinating longitudinal perspective on a landscape. I'm sure Mark will deal with a few questions if anyone would like to ask
him. You tend to see sea levels have risen 10 metres. Over what period, and was it more in the last 1,000 years or less in the last 1,000 years?
Oh, it's a hard one. Well, it has read sort of in episodic bursts. It hasn't been an even one. And the evidence we have is from Loch Moore, just published by Mick O'Connell. It's the only lake on the Arden Islands. So we see quite a substantial rise quite immediately post-glacial. And then in the end of the Bronze Age, another rise. And in early historic period, another jump up. And a much more slower rise since then. So there's been sort of three episodes of it.
When you say early historic period, what's that for us?
it's 5th, 6th century, this period. So the beginnings of Christianity in Ireland.
Is there any evidence that it went down again in the medieval period when there was a sort of little ice age on?
No, but again, this is all new. You know, no one has really, some of these questions haven't been asked yet, so we don't think so. These medieval harbours, for example, this harbour here, you could argue is evidence that it did go down, but it could also be siltation off the bay.
Mm.
So that's we don't know the straight answer to that.
Mm.
Some of these sea level changes presumably are also isostatic as the land is rebounding or tipping.
Yes, I mean, off the Cork coast, Baltimore is a lovely little sacked by the Moors,
yeah,
in the 16th century down there. But some archaeology done there, a passage tomb was found in below high water mark, beautiful, in the middle of the bay.
Right.
So on the lower coast, you have a drowned, this whole southwestern coast is a drowned landscape. All the Neolithic, the Mesolithic landscapes are completely gone. And the Antrim Plateau, the Mesolithic sites are 10 metres above the present high water mark. So you have a difference from east to west and from north to south, quite a dramatic one.
You mentioned that oral history was is important. How far back did that oral history take you when you did a dig? Like, if you said you found sites that...
Well, that's a very interesting... I just illustrated the last megalithic tomb I found, or identified, it's been there forever, was in, because I met a woman one day on the side of the road, and I'd spotted what I thought might be the side stones of a megalithic tomb in the end of it lane. This is about 400 metres back from the sea. And Mrs. Roach was driving her cow from her thatched house. This is like the last thatched house on the peninsula. And I asked her before I headed in, what was the name of this glen? And she said, Powell Uvin. Uiv is the Irish for a cleft or a grave. And I asked her, what was up there? And she said, never been up there. I said, why not? And she said, it was alive with Sheogai. Sheog is the Irish word for a spirit. So there's a resonance. Now, she didn't know it was a megalithic tomb, but the place name referred to either a cleft in the rock, or it's often used in reference to a grave. Now, she didn't know what a megalithic tomb was, but there was an ore in this particular valley that this was somewhere associated with the other world or the spirit world. And that, so where that's a direct transmission or it's an indirect one, we're not sure. But there's a strong association with this belief in the spirit world, the association with individual places with the spirit world, and in this case, with prehistoric sites. You don't know what date, and there can be Bronze Age sites, and there are often early Christian sites from 8th, 9th century. So the oral history is very, very important. Most of the megalithic tombs are called Laba, Dermot, Agus Gráinne, the bed of Dermot and Gráinne. These are two figures from the 7th, 8th century. So the sort of ancient archaeology is associated with them, are very often with Naloughlinne. Baileal Naloughlinne was a Bronze Age site, I was shown. But I got into it because of the name Naloughlinne. So from oral history, we'll interpret certain things in terms of myths and legends that are already current and projecting them onto material culture that they don't fully understand. So it's difficult to say specifically. There's an Armada wreck site, which I'm chasing, for example, which we haven't located yet, but we know it's there. And the location of it we've got recently from a farmer who told, I was up on doing some fieldwork, mapping a Bronze Age site, and he said, I mentioned the site, and he said, oh, we were drawing tar ropes off it for a week before it sunk. Now, this sank in October 1588. And this man told me where they went when it sank. The village they went into, which I went to, and it's still there, it's an abandoned ruined village now, raided by Bingham subsequently here, and they described the journey around to Renvoy Castle. Now, he had no knowledge of history, he'd never been to school. Well, had been to school, but this was a strong oral tradition. And what was authentic about it was the ropes. He didn't mention cannon, gold. It was tar ropes, which were someone in the fishing farming world. Now, that's something valuable, something that would be passed on to the generations. And it was wrecked off Carrig Lahan, and that Carrig is the site we hope to dive on soon. But it's in a high energy coast, so that if there's anything left, we'll be lucky. But so oral history is an important resource. It's not straight history, but it's hugely important, and we have a vast array of it collected since the 1930s in Ireland, often not used by archaeologists, because we don't study anthropology in Ireland. That's one of the great losses that we don't. We look at the landscape in very traditional sort of eyes, if you like. And that's where that anthropological view, which the New World has, which is would value this material more. But I just happened to grow up in the background. This was, you know, this was common part of my upbringing. Like, oral history was what we grew up with. It wasn't anything different or unusual. So I was always much more receptive to following echoes in the oral tradition back into the landscape with tremendous results.
Thank you.
I might ask a question. I'm intrigued by the continuity in oral tradition here. They look to be quite small islands. So do you have a sense of what sort of size of population we're dealing with and whether the genetics of the island have been quite stable? I mean, has there been a lot of disruption?
Well, islands are one place, in Ireland anyway, you don't look for stable population. Not stable in terms of, in the 19th century, there was a great series of articles written by scholars from Trinity, Brown and I forget the other guy's name, and cranology was all the rage at the time. And all these islands have the most detailed forensic studies done on their heads, skulls, and every bit are measured in order to look for the Aboriginal Irish. And there's this marvellous set of articles published on all these islands from 1895 to 1900. Fantastic stuff in them. Of course, cranology now is dismissed. It's useless science. But they were looking at the islands without any historical background, so they had no knowledge of its medieval history. The 17th century English fort, they had no knowledge of it being a garrison island. So a lot of these islands are garrisoned from Elizabethan times. There's Viking raids on them periodically. So genetically, they're more mixed than the mainland because of the nature of people are going to Santiago on pilgrimage. There's shipwrecks happening, you know. So they're rather than being seen as sort of an unmoving, stable society, the island cultures are actually quite dynamic in who they'll marry out. An islander will often marry out of the island to Connemara to the north or to the Bourne to the east. So you've more mixing of a population on an island than you will have in most societies on the West Coast there. So while they're traditional, they're also more open to, they're less conservative socially, for example, because they've been there, they've been in the Royal Navy, they've been here, you know, historically they've had contacts with the sea and with all that implies.
And yet such continuity in oral tradition?
Oh yeah, I mean, there would always have been a core stable population. Rattlin Island is the rare exception, where there's repeated massacres of the people on Rattlin, where you have a whole new group of people coming in. But generally, you will have elites coming in and out. The O'Flahertys come in from Connemara, wipe out, murder all the O'Briens. Elizabethan fort, they're thrown out. Cromwellian occupation periodically. And then the islands are abandoned for 2.5 centuries. But then you have a smuggling trade going on. So you have a core population, and this is the oral history is important in that you do have a core population. The elites come and go, Native Irish or English, whoever they happen to be. But there is a core population added to it periodically, but it's still a relatively stable. So the oral history, in particular anywhere on the from the uplands all the way along the west coast, is a very important source, while not a static source, if you like.
Michael, you've spoken a lot, obviously, about, you know, what is sort of ancient history, prehistory, medieval history, etc. If we could bring these islands up a little bit and more into the modern kind of period. I mean, one of the ways that this place gets picked up, as you very well know, in the late 19th century, is that this part of Ireland is where you'll find the real Ireland, and you get things like John Middleton Synge going out there writing those plays, Playboy of the Western World, his book The Aran Islands, etc., etc. You talk about the survival of the language out there and a whole range of things. Could you speak a little bit about, you know, how Aran becomes this kind of symbolic place rather than just a place which you know, where you can study all these various layers of it? What happens to it in terms of this, the symbolic presentation of Aran later on?
Yeah, well, Connemara and Aran becomes sort of key engines for the whole nationalist culture revival in the 19th century. So as well as craniologists going out there, you have folklorists, you have people like Oscar Wilde's mother, Francesca Wilde, collecting oral history on Inishbofin, Inishark. Pierce comes here, for example, into Rossmuck, Aran, Letterfrack. Pádraig Pierce, he's the leader of the 1916 rebellion. He's a strong nationalist. His father was English, ironically, but coming from a Fenian background on his mother's side. So These areas are zones of survival of Gaelic Ireland. They were perceived as being the one true Ireland, the last un-anglicised bit of Ireland. Now, they probably in medieval times were not the centre of Gaelic Ireland. In fact, we know they weren't. That was down in Munster, or centre of Ireland. But because of the expansion of English post-famine, these are Irish-speaking islands still, so they have a huge status in terms of the nationalist struggle. So they're viewed in a very particular way. So they're almost viewed sort of as a cultural zoo for Irish nationalism, if you want to put a sort of harsh view on it, which is something that irritates quite often, or did the islanders, because the people, because the only strangers they'd met were scholars and antiquarians and linguists, and everybody and every scholar known to man were out there. But they did form this very sort of, they became the imaginary Ireland, if you like, and all the hopes and dreams of nationalist Ireland hung on these impoverished islanders, if you like, and people from Connemara. So they played a huge role. Yeats comes here on his honeymoon. Augustus John is out here. Some of the big hitters in the Irish culture, not necessarily militant nationalists, but the mild cultural nationalists. So they're used, and of course the archaeology is used in a very interesting way at this period, because the island is clearly dotted with antiquities. And so archaeology gets drawn into the debate then and saying, look, we are not this bedraggled, godforsaken, feckless wasters as they're being portrayed in Punch and various magazines. Look, there's our heritage. We had a heroic past. Look at our round towers. Look at our great stone forts. We come from a proud ancient culture. And so they're using the archaeology that is found in abundance on these islands. Nationalists are looking back at these landscapes and repackaging Ireland through the eyes of the language and the culture, and also to the very obvious wealth of the richness of these islands, to sort of come up with a new agenda, a new vision, if you like, drawing from the ancient world and re-imaging it for a new vision of Ireland, and that the antiquities and the history and the folklore are very much part of that drive for a new independent state. So though they're remote and weren't involved in any but a very minor way in the national struggle, militarily or politically, symbolically these islands and their culture are hugely important, and their monuments. So that's why the study of these islands is fascinating in terms of the growth of the state itself. And of course, in terms of poetry and so on.
Just a quick question. Where the language has died out, how much has, you know, parts of Ireland that are not Irish speaking, how much of that oral tradition is lost, and how much is lost by way of references for archaeology? Is it still usable, and to what degree?
It is. I mean, I remember doing a walk in Inishlakken. It's a small island. It's off. This is Sleine Head. It's over here. There was 400 people in the 19th century. 200 died out during the famine. When I first mapped it, I was mapping it. I think two families left on it. And I remember going around it with Máirtín MacDonagh, I think his name was, from Inishnee, who was born on the island. And taken down, you know, I think we got about 150 place names right around the rim of the island. And whatever the hell, I lost the list or whatever happened. About 3 years later, I went out, but it was his son I met, also native Irish speaker. We had a third of those names. So you had two thirds in one generation of just the place names alone lost. So there's been when the language goes, an enormous amount goes with it. There's still an enormous amount left. My sister did a big survey, Catherine and Ilon, and she used women collecting. Often folklorists were men talking about manly things, fishing and wall building and all sorts of things. But an enormous amount survive within the women within that world. So often it depends on who you're asking. But once the language drifts out of the place, the small farm world will preserve a lot of the names, but not the understanding, the context. And so you have a coarsening of the culture, if you like. As every single name will have a place name will have a description, a meaning, and a particular story. So East Galway, for example, north of the Carrib, up in East Roscommon, East Mayo, the sort of centre-west of that map there, this was all Irish-speaking in the 1880s. Huge swaths. By 1900, most of this area, the language had died out, as its status had diminished so much. People abandon the language, consciously abandon the language, as they've been immigrating in vast numbers to North America and to Britain, and to here to a lesser degree.
Did every field have a name, say, in Ireland?
Almost virtually every field. Canton and Ilan, every field. Every headland, every rock. Because these were important in the small farm world. There's tremendous, and then the coast, of course, there's a huge array of place names associated with fishing. And you needed to know, because you're fishing, you need to know where these rocks are. You navigate your way through the seas by the names ahead of you. So there's a lot has been, you know, there's Tim Robinson, I suppose, work on Aran is a wonderful historical geographer, archaeologist. You can't hard put a badge on him. But the wealth of material that he's been able to draw out of that landscape, and other scholars. Were fortunate in Ireland in the 1930s, De Valera set up a folklore commission. And this commission was, whose task was to get children to go to the grandparents to record the oral history of their area. So we have an enormous amount collected from the 1920s. Most of it still, unfortunately, is one of the great tragedies of modern Ireland, is that this material isn't published. Only bits of it, but it's accessible. And it's a wonderful collection. And scholars have gone back into some of those areas doing modern versions of that. And I mean, there's a huge loss in the meantime. But the Ordnance Survey in the 19th century did record a lot with relation to the detailed 6-inch-to-mile mapping that they were doing. At the edges of the maps, within the maps themselves, they recorded quite a number of names, but a small fraction of what would have been current at the time. So the language loss is fairly culturally devastating, but not terminal. There's a rich array there, and of course and what's happening in modern Ireland now is farming, as in parts of Australia, there's a drift away from the land, and that's going to pose major challenges. Because if you own land, of course, everyone will know where the antiquities are on the land. They might know them and what the data of them are. But if that land goes out to an adjacent farmer, not from that particular town land, that historic memory passes also. So what we've been trying to do in terms of legislation is replace the sciogli with legislation. So the spirit world's protective mantle, replacing that with strong legislation, but it's not nearly as effective, because people bought into the power of the spirit world in the past. So they would, with rare exceptions, they were reluctant to damage an antiquity. Enforcement agencies don't have the influence the fairies once had in rural Irish society. So there's big challenges, because we have some extraordinary density of monuments surviving on the landscape, and these are the visible ones, not ones just below the subsoil or whatever, actual built structures on the landscape.
Just a quick comment, referring to the last few things you said. Flann O'Brien, that wonderful Irish writer who was able to cast an acerbic view on things around him, once famously said or wrote about the Aran Islands that a typical family consisted of father and mother, 6 children, and resident German anthropologist.
Well, I mean, that comment refers to the interest in the Irish language among Europe and Danish scholars, with the whole revival of interest in the Celts, I suppose, in the late 19th century. So it was an unfair comment, but it reflected a huge interest among scholars in Irish culture, and that interest is still there, and it's growing. It's wider than it ever was, so there's probably more scholars on Aran now than there's ever been.
Draw this together a little bit. I mean, it might seem this is very far from an Australian dimension, you know, what we've been hearing about, but actually it isn't, because why I sort of asked Michael about the Aran Islands and the way they're symbolically used later on, this stuff comes out to Australia, you know, in the whole sort of background of the Catholic Church, if you like. I mean, people like Cardinal Moore in Sydney are using these things. And if you think of the Celtic crosses that you see in so many Australian cemeteries, if you think of the sort of symbols of wolfhounds and harps and round towers, this is the period it's all sort of coming out of, this late 19th century Celtic revival. So these landscapes actually do get, you know, into the Catholic school system in Australia, not as any way as detailed as Michael's been talking about, but nonetheless, this becomes the resurgence, the idea of the pride in this ancient Ireland. So forget about England and Scotland and all this sort of British imperial background. You've got this counterculture as well, this idea that Ireland inherits all that, and you inherit all that if you go, you know, you're part of that Irish-Australian Catholic culture. Certainly coming into the literature, you'll find stacks and stacks of references to it. So it's not actually distant, or that distant from us at all.
Well, I certainly don't see distant. I see another set of parallels. First of all, I'd like to thank Richard for bringing Michael into the museum. Please join me in thanking Michael for this one.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.